From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Nestle gets a green light to pump more water for its bottling plant in Evert.
Well, you know, the silver lining, I guess, is that this will be the most monitored withdrawal ever in the state of Michigan.
Michigan's loss to Villanova for the NCAA crown.
It's a mistake to look at this one game and have it erase everything else. A big mistake. This team is 33-8.
Tough conversations at the White Privilege Conference.
We're not attacking people. We're not saying white people bad. We are saying white supremacy is bad.
And troubling news in research about our third graders.
If you look around the average third grade classroom in the state of Michigan, 1 in 5 children have been the focus of a formal investigation for abuse and neglect.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some 18% of third graders in Michigan have been subject to at least one formal investigation for maltreatment. That's according to a new study by two University of Michigan professors. Coming up later this hour, we talk about what this troubling news means for student performance. But first, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality has approved a permit for Nestle Waters North America to boost the amount of groundwater it's pumping from its well in Osceola County near Evert. Nestle now pumps up to 250 gallons per minute from that well, water they bottle under their Ice Mountain label. The new permit allows it to pump up to 400 gallons a minute. The DEQ approval came despite overwhelming public comment opposing the permit. James Clift is policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. James, what is your view of this permit?
Number one, we thought the application should have been denied. We did not think it complied with the statute. And obviously, the DEQ disagreed here. If you look at the permit itself, well, you know, the silver lining, I guess, is that this will be the most monitored withdrawal ever in the state of Michigan. And we'll probably learn a little bit about kind of groundwater hydrology while we're at it. You know, they'll be testing the stream flows, the groundwater levels, the acres of wetlands and how they're impacted. So when you look at that aspect of the permit, they're going to make sure that it doesn't have what they consider to be an unreasonable impact on the resource itself. But again, I think this permit has demonstrated some defects in our program. Unfortunately, a woefully underfunded program that needs more oversight, needs more kind of science so that we're better at managing these water resources for the future.
And so you're saying this is something we haven't seen, a level of monitoring we have not seen before?
No other withdrawer in Michigan is being required to do this much monitoring of their withdrawal.
What did you want to see in the permit? I mean, as you said, you didn't think it should have been approved. State apparently disagreed and has approved it. What did you want to see in the permit that's not there?
Yeah, I think what you hear, when you listen to all the public input, they're like, you know, they're getting all this water for free and selling it. What's Michigan get out of this? You know, and there's actually a provision of the statute that says that they're supposed to undertake activities, if needed, is how the statute reads, to address impacts commensurate with the nature and extent of their withdrawal. You know, we read that sentence to say, hey, what's Nestle going to give back to the state? You know, what kind of improvement projects are they going to do to make the water resources of Michigan better? And we think the statute requires those. And Nestle didn't have any in their application, and the department is not requiring any in this permit. You know, we would have liked to seen requiring Nestle to give something back. Now, a lot of people have been clamoring, oh, they should have to pay for the water. Well, the legislation would have to be changed to get to that. But at a minimum, they should have been requiring some improvement projects that would have helped offset any impact that this well will have, because it will have some impacts because they're withdrawing, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons a day.
And we probably should note that Nestle's been getting its groundwater for that $200 per year DEQ permit, and that doesn't change, does it, under this new one?
It does not.
Is that something, one of those areas you would have liked to have seen boosted up?
Well, nobody in Michigan pays for their water. You know, that's the bottom line. Nobody that withdraws water in Michigan actually pays any per gallon fee. You know, so even the water we get in our homes, you know, we're paying for its treatment and its disinfection and, you know, deliver it to our homes, but we're not actually paying for the water. Given that this program and the whole department is underfunded, should we figure out some new revenue streams, and might water be one of those? That's been raised before. You know, should there be an excise tax on bottled water? You know, I think we'd be supportive of that to help pay for these programs that are important for Michigan's future.
The MDEQ director put out a statement, and it says, quoting here, "We cannot base our decisions on public opinion because our department is required to follow the rule of law when making determinations." Now, we should note the DEQ took public comment on this, and according to Michigan Radio's count, 81,862 people wrote in. Only 75 comments were in favor. What's the purpose of this public comment period?
If you talk to the department, you know, they're asking the question, does this application comply with the law? Because we as a state agency are required to comply with the law. And give us a reason to say no. We thought we did. But you know, they're basically asking, does this application comply with the law? And that is what they would argue is the, you know, the purpose of public, you know, hearing. Hopefully a lot of these 80,000 will now turn to the state legislature and say, okay, let's make sure that this statute is designed in a way that protects Michigan's water going forward. Instead of worrying about this one permit, let's look at the law itself. Unfortunately, the law currently is under attack in the legislature. There is people in the legislature that are trying to make it easier to take Michigan's water. We've had a public hearing on the piece of legislation. There could be more this year.
James Clift is with the Michigan Environmental Council. James, thanks so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Well, the miracle that Michigan hoped for didn't happen. The Wolverines fell to Villanova last night in San Antonio. And Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubacon was right there in the Alamo Dome, and here he is with us today. You are a trooper, sir.
I'm an idiot, but thank you.
So the final score, 79-62. And national sports media is pretty much describing this as a runaway win for Nova. But what do you think?
It largely was. Look, the first 10 minutes was Michigan. They were the better team. They were hitting from all over. Mo Wagner was everything is supposed to be.
Yep.
And then the shots quit falling for Michigan. It was not that, I don't think, that Villanova played better defense or that Michigan got sloppy. It's that they simply did not make their shots. They were 3-for-23 from three-point land.
And you called it. You said those shots had to happen for them to win.
And that's what it boiled down to. And look, if they're even 9-for-23, which is about their average, well, guess what? That's 18 more points, and you got a nip-and-tuck game right there. So if they're merely average from three-point land, it's a game.
And that was their worst percentage point of the whole season.
Not a good night for that, is it?
So what do you think happened? I mean, of all times to have the bottom drop out that way, they look tired.
Two short answers. One, dumb luck. Sometimes the shots fall, sometimes they don't. So that's one thing. Although they do say it's harder to shoot in a big stadium where you don't have the background. Having said that, it did not affect Villanova.
No.
Our man, and you know who I'm talking about.
Dante DiVincenzo. What do you want to say about Dante?
I just want to say that name again because it's so cool.
It is. Dante
DiVincenzo. Good Irish
boy.
Man, I assume.
Yeah, 31 points he scored off the bench.
31 points off the bench. That's the record, by the way, breaking the old record off the bench, which was 22, which was set against, yes, Michigan in 2013. So no one's ever done this or even come close. And this guy didn't start the game, and yet was by far the hottest guy out there. He more than won the game for Villanova. So one guy was hot in the whole court, and it was this one guy who had the night of his life. When you're supposed to, and by the way, that guy's not buying a drink in Philadelphia ever again.
Again. So here we have Michigan's sixth loss in a national championship game. But let's look ahead, and what does this team and its fans take away from this overall season?
It's a mistake to look at this one game and have it erase everything else. A big mistake. This team is 33-8. That's a pretty good run, right there, I'd say. They won a Big Ten title no one expected them to win. They got to a Final Four no one expected them to get to. This is one team, by the way, with John Beilein voted by his peers to be the cleanest coach in America. They've got two banners that will go up in Chrysler next fall for the Big Ten title as well as the Final Four. And he's the one coach in America, I'm going to tell you, will not ever have to give those banners back. And Michigan has in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So if that matters to Michigan fans, second and clean versus whatever else is out there. I have no idea about Villanova.
Right.
But that should matter to Michigan fans.
Well, I saw that tweet you put out there, and a lot of fans were jumping right in to agree with you that, you know, it says good things about the future when you think of the growth that this team had. And what do you think? How much of this particular squad is going to be back next year?
Most of it. I don't think Mo Wagner is going to be back next year is my guess.
You think he'll test the NBA draft?
Yes, and test it favorably. He's a big dude who can do a lot of things. He had a great run, and they're watching.
The spotlight's been on him.
That's my guess.
Yeah.
But most of this team comes back, and guys behind the starters are also quite good. And look what John Beilein does. He took a bunch of guys in December who weren't very good and coached them up so they did not lose a game since February 6th until last night. And that's a long stretch, folks. That's pretty good. So these guys can coach them up, and they will.
And there's fire in the belly from last night to take into next
Always.
Season. And tournament action is not over for Michigan. The men's hockey team in the Frozen Four playing Notre Dame Thursday night.
Yeah, and they've played Notre Dame four times, played them hard all four times, 2 one-goal losses and 2 very impressive victories over now the top team out there. So going to be a battle, I'm sure. But look, they're there. They were not supposed to be there for 3 or 4 more years. And Mel Pearson got them there in his first season after they had 13 wins last year. Now they're flying. So that's whatever they do from here on in is gravy. I don't know if there's an AD in America who's had a better month than Ward Manuel. When both your hockey and your basketball team are in the Final Four, and no one else is even close as far as that goes. Man, win or lose, Michigan's had a hell of a good year.
Michigan Radio sports commentator, John Eubanks. Time for some sleep. Thank you so much, John
Eubanks.
Still to come, tough conversations coming up at the White Privilege Conference.
We're not attacking people. We're not committed to degrading, demeaning people. We're not saying white people bad. That's not anywhere in any of the things that we do. We are saying white supremacy is bad.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The focus is on race and privilege as hundreds of people gather in Grand Rapids for the 19th annual White Privilege Conference. It's happening tomorrow through Saturday. And here with us now is the executive director of the Privilege Institute, Eddie Moore Jr. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
What is the mission of this conference, Eddie?
The mission of this conference is really to create a space and place where we're talking about issues beyond diversity, diversity at a high level. So we believe and committed to exploring issues of diversity and bringing folks into the conversation, but we think there needs to be an additional space for the tough conversations related to power, privilege, and leadership. And that's what this conference is committed to and what the space has been designed to do.
So take us deeper into some of the issues and topics that you want to have explored during this week's conference.
Yeah, well, more specifically, one of the top issues is white supremacy. Is the understanding of white supremacy, its design since its early existence in our nation, and what that looks like today, recent to things like Charlottesville. So the subject matter of white supremacy, as well as white privilege, which is some of the remnants of what extends from a organization designed with a belief in white people being supreme, white supremacy, is people who may not believe in that philosophy, still may get the benefits of the structures designed in that way. So the understanding of white privilege, as well as privilege in general, our motto is everybody has privilege, and we believe that folks are just impacted in very different ways. So a lot of our workshops look at gender privilege, religious privilege, ability privilege. So we really work hard to cover the conversation of privilege comprehensively.
And I have to imagine that some of these conversations can get difficult because you probably have people who don't see that privilege because it's so much, it's been a part of their life since the moment they've been born.
Absolutely. But that's what we take pride in, is trying to create a space where tough conversations can happen. It's like fitness. I mean, only few people can go to CrossFit fitness class. But, you know, some folks like their fitness at that high level, at that tough level. And so that's really kind of the framework that I approach, just like in any curriculum when we're teaching and learning our kids or even at the college level. There are certain classes that are just tough classes that not everybody can take. And so the idea here is to create a space and place where we can have conversations that are tough around diversity, that go beyond diversity, but we do it with a foundation of love. We're not attacking people. We're not committed to degrading, demeaning people. We're not saying white people bad. That's not anywhere in any of the things that we do. We are saying white supremacy is bad. White cultural dominance, frameworks designed in those limited, narrow ways, and sometimes even destructive ways, absolutely those are bad. And so we're trying to create the kind of space where we can have those tough discussions, those tough conversations, not agreeing all the time, not to say it's going to be kumbaya, but to actually enter into that with a foundation of love, community, and family, and be okay disagreeing, but at least feel like we had the tough conversation.
Eddie, what do you say to people who resist or don't want to have those kinds of conversations?
Well, two things. I'm not spending my time with the most resistant folks anymore. It's just not healthy. I've learned there's some pancakes you'll never flip over. Not that I'm not having conversations, I'm willing, but I completely understand now there are some folks who just won't make any movement, won't budge when it comes to this topic. And what I'm saying to them, hey, I appreciate where you're coming from, but at some point, I got to let that conversation go. What I'm willing and interested in talking with and being a part of is environments of people that, again, they're not going to always agree with everything that I say, but they're at least willing to have the conversation. And so I think that we have had too much time in our nation where we've been divisive and segregated. And so what I'm trying to create at this conference is a kind of space where we can be in disagreement, but we still are family. We're still community. We're still able to grapple with tough topics with a foundation of love and still leave in relationship, in friendship, and partnership.
Eddie, who are the kinds of people who attend these conferences? I know this is your 19th one. You've been all over the country, and here you are in West Michigan. Who comes to these conferences?
Yeah, one of the things that makes the conference great is we get a diverse group of people. I mean, the diversity is racial, across different racial identifiers. It's also across other kinds of identifiers as far as class, as far as gender, as far as religion. And we also get a mix of people coming from different sectors, as well as including things like education, of course, higher ed, K-12, but as well as folks coming from corporate, as well as nonprofit. So it's a good mixture of people in many different ways. And we're one of the few conferences that also has young people, high school kids, learning about this topic as early as, you know, ninth grade. So we wanted to create a space that gives young people, if they're ready, an opportunity to explore some tough topics as well. So we are fortunate that we get a good mixture of folks coming from a variety of places, of course, across the nation, but also across the world. And I think that that actually allows for the conversation to be even richer because we have such a diverse group of people grappling with it.
We are talking on the eve of the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. What do you imagine that Dr. King would think or say if he could stand among us right now in the United States of 2018?
Well, I really believe that Dr. King would be an acknowledgement of some progress. I mean, particularly coming off of seeing our first multiracial or black president and President Obama, but also, I mean, recently seeing some of the resurgence of white supremacist groups in the public sector of our public society, publicly, you know, really giving some attention to their cause, I think would be something that he would, I think, would have thought would have ended in those times that he was out on the streets just fighting for basic human treatment. So what I think, and when I think about the 50th anniversary, is I feel like this is the topic that Dr. King was really beginning to turn his attention to and really begin to tackle and grapple with head on. White supremacy, issues of class, but also how people of different groups and backgrounds can come together and have this conversation beyond, you know, can we just sit at the restaurant and have dinner together, which is important, and it took some real sacrifice to get that, but that's not where we stop. We got to now look at systems, organizations, institutions, and really making them a more inclusive place, but also a more accessible place for power, privilege, and leadership, and people from all backgrounds to be in those positions.
Eddie Moore Jr. is Executive Director of the Privilege Institute, holding the 19th Annual White Privilege Conference, running Wednesday through Saturday in Grand Rapids. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate y'all. Take care. Thanks for the time.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Sorry if you're feeling frisky. I ain't fighting no one.
It is time once again to check in on the bustling West Michigan music scene as we say hello to journalist and music critic John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com. And John, you want to spotlight a couple of West Michigan bands who've entered the NPR Tiny Desk Concert Contest. Remind us again just what is that and what winners get?
So every year, this is actually a very fun event that the NPR Music Office of All Songs Considered has staged. And what it does is it hundreds and hundreds of bands and solo artists send in music video entries from across the country in hopes of winning a chance to play an official Tiny Desk Concert in Washington, D.C. And these Tiny Desk Concerts have gotten very popular, and a lot of very well-known artists have performed there. And if they win this contest, they not only get to play one of those, but they also earn a spot on the national NPR Lagunitas tour. And these videos are grassrootsy, very down-to-earth representations of these bands. They're often filmed in living rooms and bedrooms and garages and basements. And I thought it'd be fun this month to spotlight a couple of those well-known West Michigan artists who have new music that they've entered into this contest. And then along with a new release from a sort of an under the radar, but a very well-respected artist here from the Grand Rapids area.
All right. So who should we start with?
It'd be very easy to start with this band because they got some attention last year for their video entry, and I'm talking about the Crane Wives. They are a very popular folk rock band here in the Grand Rapids area who've really developed a national audience for their music. They didn't win last year, but their video for this song that they put out called High Horse has racked up more than 117,000 views on YouTube. And the band, which features singers and guitarists Emily Petersmark and Kate Pillsbury, drummer Dan Rickabus, and bassist and studio owner Ben Zito, decided to enter a catchy new song this year. They call the song Daydreamer, and they filmed it in kind of a living room setting. And, you know, they've been around for about 8 years, and they've really developed an audience, and they've done a lot with their studio albums have gotten some attention, and they keep expanding their sound. They've gotten a little more electric over the last couple of years, and they've invested a lot of time in side projects that I think have really boosted their creativity and added a lot more to the table when it comes to some of the music that they perform as a band. In fact, the drummer, Dan Rickabus, recently released a pretty well-regarded solo album that involved a whole whole bunch of different musicians from the West Michigan area, and they're touring all over the country. And it'll be fun to see how much attention they might get for their new song and their new entry here that they've sort of submitted to NPR.
All right, let's take a listen to a little bit of this year's entry, Daydreamer. So when can folks see them in Michigan?
So their next Michigan show is here in Grand Rapids at Creston Brewery in Grand Rapids on April 22. They also play the Rumpus Room in Chelsea on May 6th. And before that, they're going to be touring a bunch of college campuses. They're going to be in Ohio and Iowa and Pennsylvania, Wisconsin and New York. And I know they're going to be traveling to Texas later this year to play the Kerrville Folk Festival.
So they're busy. Now, who's the second group in the Tiny Desk Concert Contest?
Well, I've known Jake Stilson. He's a singer-songwriter from Grand Rapids, and I've known him for many years, and he's dabbled in a variety of projects, everything from rock to solo stuff and gospel music and blues. But when he really hit on starting to play this vintage outlaw country music, he really hit his stride. And his band, the Bootstrap Boys, have become a very rollicking country band, and they recently released a live album. They just actually released it last week, and it was recorded live last fall at Founders Brewing here in Grand Rapids, and it really shows off their sort of boot-stomping, vintage-sounding, heel-kicking, glass-tipping kind of music, which really resonates with an audience, especially in a live setting. They do, you know, some cover songs as well as part of that. They're going to be doing a June 8th tribute to Johnny Cash at the Pyramid Scheme, where they're going to be playing Folsom Prison Blues and live at Folsom Prison all the way through. So they definitely have that vibe, and they've been a lot of fun to watch. You know, if you're into sort of this vintage honky-tonk kind of music, these guys are a great one to watch live.
So we'll take a listen now to a track off of the Bootstrap Boys live.
One of these days we'll get on out from under the poverty line. I hope I get to live a little before I die under the poverty line. On an old dirt road off the rural route under the poverty line. Still ain't figured a damn thing out under the poverty line. Gotta work, gotta work.
But they are entering a different song for the Tiny Desk Contest.
Yes, they did. They've got a new song called Time to Kill that they've entered in the Tiny Desk Contest this year, so we'll see how that does along with all these other Michigan entries, and there's dozens and dozens of Michigan entries this year. So if you want to take a look at them, you can go to localspins.com, and I've listed videos from dozens of these Michigan acts that have submitted them, and I think the winner of the contest will be announced here within a few weeks.
Great. And then not related to Tiny Desk, you wanted to talk to us about a band called Chain of Lakes.
Yeah, Chain of Lakes is led by singer-songwriter Kyle Rashi, and his earlier work has been very laid-back folk music with a kind of an atmospheric feel. Wonderful songwriter, but for this particular project, I think he's really ramped things up considerably. He has an amazing band backing him throughout this album that he calls In and In, and it has a folk rock, Americana, and pop vibe. There are great harmonies. There's some up-tempo foot tappers on this, as well as a bunch of poignant ballads, and he's got a great cast of musicians performing with him. Matt Churchill is a great bassist here from the Grand Rapids area. Joshua Davis, of course, Christian Van Antwerpen, Jordan Griffiths, Eric Ellis, Dana Jackson, Kyle Vanderveen. And these are great songs with wonderful lyrical depth. The one thing I like about what he does is that it's very engaging for a listener. If you really listen to the lyrics, you can really get a lot out of it and really understand where he's coming from when it comes to really talking about relationships and preserving love through difficult times.
Let's listen to a track now from In and In. This track is I Swear.
I swear, darling, come what may. I'm not trying to be lazy, but just please don't roll away, dear. Let's ride the others off for the day. Let's pardon every debt to be paid. Let's swear we'll never wander away, 'cause
That is great stuff. I really, really like that sound of, from Chain of Lakes. And any upcoming dates for shows in Michigan?
Yes, they'll be performing May 16th at Speakeasy Lounge here in downtown Grand Rapids. The album officially was released digitally last week, so if you guys are interested in checking that out, you can look it up in a variety of different sources, including Bandcamp and elsewhere. Definitely fun to hear this guy play, and he always surrounds himself with wonderful musicians.
And you can learn more about these and lots of other artists with West Michigan roots. Just go to localspins.com, which is edited and published by John Sinkovich. As always, John, thanks so much for our tour of West Michigan artists.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for tuning in. And over the next couple of months, I think we're going to be focusing on some of the bands that are going to be performing at all these marvelous Michigan music festivals that are coming up this summer and fall.
Get us in the mood for summer, John. Thanks so much.
Have a great week.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If a third grader scores poorly on those standardized math and reading tests, there may be a lot more to the problem than just the school, according to an eye-opening new study. The research was conducted by two University of Michigan professors, Joseph Ryan, who's an associate professor of social work and co-director of the Child and Adolescent Data Lab, and his colleague Brian Jacob, who's co-director of the Youth Policy Lab as well as a professor of education policy. Joseph Ryan is with us now. You and your colleague Brian Jacob looked at state data on child maltreatment records and then cross-checked that with educational data on all public school children in Michigan. What did you find?
I should say that this is a partnership between the university and the state of Michigan and our colleagues at the Department of Health and Human Services and the Michigan Department of Education.
So you had a lot of players involved in looking at this.
That's right. And it really takes this level of collaboration because these agencies historically do not share information. Education uses education data to solve education problems. Department of Health and Human Services use Health and Human Services data to solve problems related to child abuse and neglect and juvenile justice and things like that.
So you were able to break down some of those silos and kind of cross-check and
That's
cross-reference.
Right. That's right. And to the layperson, it makes a lot of sense mm-hmm. because if you're interested in academic outcomes, it's important to know what's going on in school, but it's certainly important to know whether the child is involved in the foster care system, whether the parents are incarcerated, all these other major life events that are going on that we think will have an important role in academic trajectories through elementary school.
So when you did this data cross-check, what did you find?
We found that about 20%, 18% exactly, of third graders had been the focus of a child abuse neglect investigation. This is prior to their entering third grade, so by 8 years old. We're interested in their subsequent academic outcomes, but the rate at which children are involved with the child abuse and neglect system, I think, will be surprising to a lot of people. If you look around the average third grade classroom in the state of Michigan, 1 in 5 children have been the focus of a formal investigation for abuse and neglect.
And you found some schools had even higher rates.
Wide variation. So some down into the single digits and some individual schools up around 60%. So it would be considered the norm.
That's kind of jaw-dropping.
Well, when we ask people who work in social work or some of these settings, they always say hi, but we don't really know exactly what they mean. But I was surprised that it was nearly 20%.
And what kinds of traumas did you find that these youngsters were experiencing?
So the most common or frequent type of maltreatment that children experience is neglect, inadequate supervision, inadequate sort of housing. That's about 75-80% of all abuse and neglect reports. Substance abuse is clearly a big factor in families getting involved with the child welfare and the child protection system. About 25% physical abuse, and then somewhere 3-4% sexual abuse.
What do we know about
what that kind of trauma, that kind of picture of trauma, what can that produce in terms of one's life, of a child's life circumstances and performance?
Well, it creates a lot of challenges for a young child. If you think of their ability to establish relationships with adults, just issues of trust and relationships early on, bonding, which we know has long-lasting impacts on child development, and then a whole host of other outcomes, including subsequent involvement with the juvenile justice system as an adolescent, employment difficulties, certainly some evidence on the foster care and participation in the foster care and their ability to graduate high school.
What pointed you and Professor Jacob to this idea of doing this kind of cross-check of data?
We have long been interested in linking state administrative data to really get a better understanding how children, adolescents, families are moving through these systems. We think about these systems serving individual, unique families, but really there's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of overlap between adolescents in the foster care system and adolescents in the juvenile justice system. Obviously, all the children in the public schools, about a little more than 90% of children in Michigan enroll in public schools, so we know they're spending a great deal of time there. And so we talked about linking these data to first understand the problems and then to use these data to help solve some of these problems.
Why did you focus on third graders?
Third graders is the first year for the standardized tests here in Michigan. So it made sense to look at their earliest standardized academic outcomes.
So how did you see these scores reflective of the kinds of traumas these youngsters have gone through?
Third graders not involved with the child abuse and neglect system, 65% reached proficiency in reading, and 57% of those involved with the child welfare system, child protection, reached proficiency. And it was 51% versus 44% for math. So already pretty far behind.
And here we are knowing that the state is preparing to hold back third graders who don't hit the mark with their reading scores.
That's right. You can see where that policy makes sense, you know, just in a general conversation, right? We don't want to pass students on. But the question is, who will then get held back? And the second question is being held back the right intervention? Is that what kids need at third grade, another year of third grade? Or could we have done something differently in kindergarten or first, second grades that would have helped them reach proficiency?
Did you see, for example, urban, suburban, and rural areas where there are differences?
Sure. There's big differences by race, by poverty, by geography, so urban and rural schools. Children who are involved with child protection more likely to be African American, more likely to come from poor families, more likely to come from urban environments. The impact, we didn't look at the impact per se of maltreatment and whether that varies, but there were certainly clear differences in one's likelihood of having contact with the child abuse neglect system.
When you say that 18% of third graders subject to at least one formal investigation for maltreatment, so one in five kids sitting in that third grade classroom, that is a pretty significant number. So what do you see as the main takeaways here?
How can schools prepare themselves to deal with a highly traumatized student population? So in schools where it's 20, 30, 40, 50%, there ought to be some programs, support services in place so that by the time a child reaches third grade, they're not already behind academically. Those gains, I would suspect, will be difficult to make up over time. It's thinking about what can schools do to support these students so that they can progress through school at an equal rate to their peers.
How do you think we should be rethinking things based on what you found, particularly in terms of intervention and in policy?
Well, that part's not as clear as one might like, and this is where our partnership with the state comes in. If you think about the partnership, the state really is the experts in what's going on in the field and also in terms of policymaking. There's clearly some confidentiality and legal issues with sharing data. We don't foresee any scenario where teachers are receiving reports at the beginning of the academic year that say, here's the eight students in your classroom that have involvement with the child abuse and neglect system. There's probably real problems to that. Teachers might treat those students quite differently. And there's a whole host of legal issues with that as well. But it doesn't mean that schools can't prepare themselves on how to support children coming from home environments. I mean, we do this for poor students in terms of breakfast programs, free and reduced lunch. We do this for students with peanut allergies. And so it's thinking about what is it we're doing with, in particular for abused and neglect children who are coming into the classroom so that they can have an equal opportunity to succeed.
And it strikes me that there needs to be more to the conversation among states around state educational policy than the school has failed or teachers have failed if test scores are not what they should be.
Oh, that's right. And we don't see that as any implication in our work. I mean, teachers are asked to do a lot more than I think most folks know.
But we hear that theme sometimes from Lansing. What are we going to do to fix the schools?
Sure.
But what you're saying is you have some children coming in who are just bearing a burden that may be invisible until you start doing some.
That's right. What we think about is we want students who show up to school and are ready to learn. So whether this is increased access to early intervention, most of these children experienced abuse or neglect prior to reaching kindergarten. So the question is maybe there's opportunities for early intervention that can get these kids up to speed by the time they hit kindergarten so that by the time they hit third grade, they're not as far behind.
Where do you think you'll go now with this information you have?
We're interested in partnering with some school districts to look at different interventions that might narrow this achievement gap. We're interested in whether or not these differences are exacerbated over time or diminish over time. We're interested in following some of these adolescents into other service systems like the juvenile justice system, the adult correctional system. So what we know by linking a lot of these data is children and families that show up in state agencies, they've been involved with the state for quite some time. So when we look at adolescents involved with the juvenile justice system, about 60% have had prior contact with the child protection system. And on average, they've been involved with them for 8 years. So it's not as if they show up at 14 or 15 with these complex problems. We're trying to figure out ways, are there opportunities for intervention earlier on so that we can prevent or at least limit the cascade of these secondary problems?
Do you get a chance ever to interact with these youngsters to get a sense of who that little person is sitting in that desk?
Prior to going to graduate school, I spent a number of years working in child welfare and juvenile justice agencies. And even today, almost all of our work is in collaboration with either state agencies, but also in teaching. We spend a lot of time in different service settings so that it's not just about data.
Well, the study is absolutely challenging and fascinating, and I've been talking with the co-author, Joseph Ryan, Associate Professor of Social Work and Co-Director of the Child and Adolescent Data Lab at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your work with us.
My pleasure.
We turn now to another Minding Michigan, where we explore mental health and wellness issues. Today, suicide. One person in Michigan dies by suicide around every 6 hours. And the CDC tells us men are 4 times more likely to die by suicide. Michigan is making a concerted effort to reach out to men with a project called Healthy Men Michigan, promoting mental wellness among men in our state. Dr. Jody Jacobson-Fry is an associate professor of social work at the University of Maryland and a principal investigator of the Healthy Men Michigan Research Project. Welcome.
Thank you, Cindy. It's great to be with you.
That Michigan suicide rate, the one suicide death for about every 6 hours, is that rate on the increase?
It is increasing, actually, and you mentioned an increased number among men, which is my focus. We see increasing rates of suicide death among working-aged men, ages 25 to 64, and this is especially true throughout Michigan, where suicide is the fourth leading cause of injury death among men in that age group. So that's where our Healthy Men Michigan campaign is really focused.
So through your investigative work for this project, what did you learn about why men are at such a higher risk?
There's a lot that we don't know about men and depression and suicide and related risk factors. You know, a lot of what we know about suicide with women is that they attempt suicide more, but men often are more likely to use more lethal means. So they actually die by suicide more often. And those numbers have been steadily increasing over the past 2 decades. Researchers and theorists and practitioners have a lot of potential reasons as to why this might be going on. But one in particular that we're really focused on in Michigan is that men who may be suffering and struggling are feeling isolated and in silence. They're not reaching out and talking with other folks about their emotions, their depression, or even their suicide thoughts as much as women may be. So the typical messages that we use in the mental health field of how we reach out to folks that may be struggling, they have not been working with trying to engage men in help-seeking behavior. So this project in Michigan is really trying to take an innovative view and look a little bit differently as to how can we reach out to men in the community that maybe are not linked up with primary care physicians and behavioral health professionals in the same way that other folks may be that are also struggling with depression.
Which leads us to talk about men in rural areas. That's a big thrust of this project.
It is. I mean, one of the biggest risk factors for suicide among men that we're finding out in the Healthy Men Michigan study as well is feeling isolated and withdrawing. So men who are struggling with depression often experience that as feeling empty and disengaging from friends and families and withdrawing. So if you couple that with being in a more rural area, which tends to have more isolation, the risk for suicide and other mental health conditions increases exponentially. So this study is funded by the CDC, and the CDC also has some interesting data that came out about a year ago looking at people that may be at higher risk due to their occupation. And I think something that is really connected to what we're seeing with rural men is that one of the highest risk industries is farming, and tends to be more rural farming where we see increased suicide rates among men.
So when people go to healthymenmichigan.org, there's a different kind of outreach message crafted for the men. In a nutshell, how is it different from the traditional approach?
What we're doing with Healthy Men Michigan is blending the best of two different programs and embedding some research into that to see what works with online screening. So in the past, one of my partners, Screening for Mental Health out of Boston, does a lot of depression and anxiety and alcohol screening with working age adults. And the majority of folks that go online to take a self-assessment and screening are women. So a couple years ago, they started partnering with an organization called Man Therapy. And mantherapy.org is something that came out of Colorado as an online, completely different take on mental health and suicide prevention that uses what we call manly messages, stories of resilience and triumph, and humor, actually, to try to engage men in thinking about their mental health and well-being and their suicide risk. So we've blended aspects of that marketing and the messaging that really is designed specifically for working-aged men, and then we've coupled that with a formal online assessment for depression and suicide to reach out to men wherever they might be in the community at any time that they're ready to take the assessment, to get immediate feedback about their risk status, and then to get referral resources throughout the state in all the different regions in Michigan. What's innovative and interesting, in addition to the messaging we're using, which we're reaching men through Facebook, through Twitter, lots of online mechanisms, as well as over 200 partner organizations throughout the state are promoting Healthy Men Michigan with our posters, our wallet cards, our coasters, our magnets, and getting the messaging out there in a more engaging way. If you look at healthymenmichigan.org or follow us on Facebook or Twitter, you'll see that we use humor to actually bring up, could you be at risk for suicide? And that's something that is really new in the field, but it's resonating very well with working age men. They're telling us that it wasn't as stigmatized to go online, and they feel less alone when they find out other people may also be struggling with the same feelings and that there's actually some help out there for me. So we're starting to really reach a population throughout Michigan that is not connected to any traditional mental health services.
Dr. Jody Fry, Principal Investigator of the Healthy Men Michigan Research Project, and once again, the website healthymenmichigan.org. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
And one quick reminder, you can join the discussion around Michigan's mental health system at our next Issues in Ale event. Stateside's executive producer, Joe Lindstroth, will lead the conversation with an excellent panel of guests tomorrow night, 6:30 p.m. at the Jolly Pumpkin Dexter. Today's Stateside was directed by Ali Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.